Good morning, Kansas City. To say that the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was a complex organization is an understatement. It was a group born of complex racial, social, and political triggers. Along with the popular images of black berets, leather jackets, and guns, there was the reality of free breakfast programs, educational initiatives, and all this was wrapped up in an institution that was in constant search for an identity among its own members and part of the larger American mosaic as well. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabulani LaFall. Joining us now is Jamal Joseph, a former Black Panther and author of the memoir Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. He's now a full professor and former chair of Columbia University's Graduate Film Division and is also the artistic director of the New Heritage Theater in Harlem. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, tell us about your memoir, Panther Baby. Why you decided to write it and where the title comes from?
Well, the decision to write the book came from a number of young people in my youth program at Columbia, and when I traveled the country, asking me the same question. This actually happened last night with a young librarian. We were having dinner, and he said, "What was it like?" And the curiosity and passion that he had in his eyes said to me that not just a kind of academic retelling or analysis of what it was like being in the Black Panther Party or what the Black Panther Party stood for, but my experiences, what I felt in the pit of my stomach, what I felt in my heart and in my mind when at 15 years old I joined the Panthers in Harlem. What was that experience like? What was the energy like? The people? What did we struggle for? What did we do when we weren't panthering, so to speak, you know, at night or, you know, in between the Panther meetings? Also, I work with a lot of young people, and the legacy of struggle, the legacy of the possibility of change is something that it's our responsibility to pass on. We have companies who treat our young people as consumers, and they make sure they pass on the information that they want our young people to have in terms of getting the latest products, the latest iPhone, these video games. So they're passing information on. We have to be vigilant, assertive, passionate about giving our young people the information that they need to function as human beings and as people of the planet, progressive folks in this society.
So as opposed to passing on information for consumption, you're passing along information for future production.
Yes, absolutely. You know, there was a saying in the movement that that young people are our greatest natural resource and that the youth will make the revolution. And that's true. Now, some of the tools of the revolution of change may have varied over the years. You know, the Panthers, when they started, patrolled the streets of Oakland, California with shotguns and law books. The guns were legal at the time, and law books were to let folks in the community and the police, when the Panthers were observing arrests, let them know that they were well aware of their rights to observe, their rights to advise the person who was being arrested, and their right to self-defense. And Bobby Seale, who was the co-founder of the Black Panther Party, said those were the dynamic weapons of social change in the Oakland, California area when the Panthers started. As you mentioned earlier, there were, of course, breakfast programs and liberation schools and health clinics and clothing programs and housing programs. But Bobby Seale said if the Panthers were starting today, Panthers would still be on the street and in the community doing the programs. But when they'd be patrolling the street, they'd be carrying, instead of shotguns and law books, they'd be carrying laptop computers and video cameras, because these are the dynamic weapons of change today. But we have to use them as tools of social change, not just tools of consumption and social media and getting connected and then deciding that the phone that we got just, you know, a few months ago now has to be upgraded, or that we need more apps. We need more apps, but we need people applying themselves in the community in hands-on programs and mentoring and education and well-being in our communities.
Tell people there's an app for that.
There's an app for that. That's right. That's the great. We should make a big G. That's the grassroots app. And all of a sudden you find yourself like not just looking at an app, but zapped to a place in the community where our elderly, our youth, where our people who are struggling with health care really need you on the ground doing that work.
Let's go back to your childhood and the events that led you to joining the party. You talked about the Panthers at the California Legislative Chambers, an enduring image with guns and leather jackets, and you said to yourself as a teenager, according to the accounts in your book, they're crazy. So you immediately wanted to join.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us about that.
Well, the lead up to that was the the tragic assassination of Dr. King. And I was involved in the NAACP Youth Council through my church and through a community center that I went to. So I cared about the civil rights movement. I believe very much in what Dr. King was doing. But there was even then this debate in the community about, you know, whether you were in the civil rights movement or the black power movement. And there was this word called black militant that was around. I didn't fully understand. You know, you'd see Stokely Carmichael on TV. You'd see H-Rap Brown. The day that Dr. King was assassinated, I went down to 125th Street in Harlem. People were rioting. I was on the fringes of the riots, almost got arrested, almost got shot, made it home. But then the next day went to school and just announced, you know, out of my anger that I'm going to be a black militant. Not quite sure what the word was. In fact, one of my friends said, I don't know, Eddie, if you can say you're going to be a black militant like that's a career choice, like you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. And I was like, no, you watch. I'm going to be a militant. So as much to follow this path, but to prove to my friends, I had to find the most militant organization out there. And then a few days later, the Panthers, the story of the Panthers storming the state capitol in Sacramento with guns because they wanted to change the gun control laws. Because when California said that any citizen could carry a gun as long as they didn't have a record and wasn't concealed, they didn't mean black men with leather jackets who were revolutionaries.
With really big guns.
With really big guns.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Panthers responded by showing up to protest and storm the legislature and the these powerful white legislatures who had been in, you know, all their lives, you know, just used to kind of making laws and saw these men coming in with guns and ducked. They were climbing under tables and out the way, and the Panthers gave this very powerful statement about the constitutional right to bear arms and the brutality of the police. And I looked at them. I said, they're crazy. They got leather coats. They got guns. They, you know, they said they had communist literature in the trunk. They're crazy. I want to join that one. Because when you're a kid, you want to be down with the roughest and the toughest. Well, on our way to the Panther office, there was a long subway ride from my grandmother's house to the Panther office. My friends were telling me stuff like, man, when you get in, you can't get out. It's like the mafia. You know you got to prove yourself. You know you may have to kill a white dude to be a Panther. You may have to bring in a cop's badge and his gun. And I'm going inside, scared to death, but I couldn't be a punk in front of my boys. I go, I don't care. And we get to the Panther office, and the person who was running the community meeting was explaining the Panther 10-point program.
And let's talk about that. When you first went to that first meeting, when you first joined up, contrary to popular belief, you found out, as he was outlining the 10-point program, that it wasn't about a war on white people, but you said you had your own agenda and thoughts. And then when you stood up and said you could kill white people in a minute, and you were asked to come up to the desk, and you thought that you were going to get
I thought he was
going
to give me a big gun. Because
right.
This is – now, I'm not even listening to what the 10-point program is really saying. If you go online, you see that it talks about housing and education and – you know, healthcare, all those things. Nothing in there about killing white people. And so when I stood up and I said, choose me, brother, arm me. I'd kill a white dude right now. He said, come here, young brother. And he hands me a stack of books, Autobiography of Malcolm X, Wretched of the Earth by Fanon, Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute.
And a Mao Zedong book as well.
And a Mao Zedong, the famous little quotations from Chairman Mao Zedong, the Red Book. And I'm thinking, this must be a test, right? Because of all the stuff my boys were saying. So I said, excuse me, brother. I'm responding to the test. I said, excuse me, brother. I thought you were going to arm me. And he said, excuse me, young brother. I just did. And that was the first moment in the Black Panther Party. And then he asked me a question. He said, you know, I want to ask you, since you came here so mad at white folks and you want to kill somebody. He said, if all of the cops who were brutalizing people were black and the people being shot up and locked up were white, if all of the business owners who have these stores where they have high prices and spoiled vegetables and rotten meat, if they were white and the people being ripped off were black. I mean, if they were black and the people being ripped off were white. He said, and all the politicians, the judges, the prison wardens, if all of them were black and the people who were in prison and in poverty and being exploited were white. He said, would that make things correct? And this time I answered with part of my brain instead of my bruised adolescent ego. And I said, no, sir. It seems like it would still be wrong. He said, that's right, brother. He said, this is a class struggle for liberation, not just a race struggle. Study those books so you know what this revolution is about.
And there was a second instance where after they had kicked that knowledge to you, you thought you were going to get a gun. You went back. And what did they give you the second time? As another
so now I'm now I'm back. And they said, we got another mission for you, because they knew I was like secret missions. And they said, we have an assignment for you. I said, now I'm going to get my gun. And this time I held up my hand and they gave me a pancake spatula and sent me to work in the Panthers free breakfast program. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm reading books, I'm making pancakes. Is this what being a Panther was about? And yes, that's what being a Panther was about. And the idea of the breakfast program is a simple idea, and it still exists. You know, they talk about struggling schools and how students are not paying attention. And the Panthers said, well, it's really hard for a kid in kindergarten or first grade to be learning arithmetic and to listen to a teacher say three apples plus two apples equal five apples and their stomach is growling. So food is a fundamental need.
I need those two apples to eat.
I need those to eat so that I can pay attention.
Right.
So what the Panthers learned in the civil rights movement and what they built upon was this idea of grassroots organization, being around, organizing people around their needs because you care, because you love folk. So folk in the community who you want to come to talk to, you know, who don't have a job, who don't have a place to lead, and you want to come with an idea that's a little abstract to them. Freedom, my brother, liberation. And brothers say, man, I'm trying to get something to eat here, trying to get a job. Because it's that basic, because freedom to someone who is hungry is a meal. Liberation to someone who is homeless is a warm, dry, safe, warm place to sleep. So you organize folks around that. And you then use them to show them how to organize within their communities. First, helping people deal with their needs. And second, using that to point out the contradiction to a system that was then had a large disparity between the rich and the poor. These days, a growing disparity between the rich and the poor. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. And in between the slogans and the rhetoric, between the left and the right and the center, between everything that's going on, are people who are in dire need, and real grassroots organizers, real community action folks organize and try to take care of those needs.
When did you first discover? You changed your name from Eddie to Jamal and got real militant and got involved at a very young age in the Black Panther Party. But when did you discover for yourself that this was a very serious revolutionary endeavor and that the American government considered this group both armed and dangerous and a threat to national security?
Well, it truly sank in. I joined the Panthers when I was 15 years old, and it was, again, in the early days of my being a Panther. It might have been the first or the second day. I saw a poster of Bobby Hutton, who joined the Panthers when he was 15 years old. He was actually the first person to join when Huey Newton and Bobby Seale founded the organization in 1966. He was the first to join, and he was killed when he was 17 years old. And this was a shootout that happened. It was a shoot-in. The cops just began open fire on a basement that Eldridge Cleaver and Bobby Hutton was in. And he was 17 years old. And there was this poster that said, the first to join and the first to die. And I remember looking at Bobby Hutton and saying, I was the same age. I'm the same age that he was when he joined the Panther Party. So you always heard, because even then, I had joined the Panther Party 2 years after it was founded, about people who were in prison. Huey Newton was in prison at the time. Panthers were being arrested. Panthers were being killed. But it hit home for me in a personal way about 5.5 months after I joined the Panthers, when the cops kicked in the door of my grandmother's house at 4 o'clock in the morning and arrested me. And I was taken to prison. And I was charged in a case that became known as the Panther 21 case.
Right.
And my bail was set at $100,000. I had just turned 16 years old, and I was charged with conspiracy to commit murder, weapons possession, and was told that I was facing 360-plus years.
And this is around the same time that in Chicago the cops raided Fred Hampton's house.
Absolutely. It was a few months after that.
And shot him dead. Right.
And shot Fred Hampton, who was 21 years old.
People forget that. He was only 21 years old. Yeah.
The first day, just to go back to my first day in the Panthers, you know, when I'm sitting there before I worked up the courage to jump up and said, you know, I want to join, you know, give me a gun, I'm looking at all of these cool older brothers and sisters, right, that had on their Panther jackets, pardon me, fatigue jackets, the berets, some of the sisters had on African galas, and I'm looking at these cool older brothers and sisters. Well, they were older brothers and sisters to me because I was 15 years old, but they were 19, 20, 21, 22 years old. The average age of someone in the Black Panther Party was about 19 or 20 years old. Brothers and sisters who were there to really put their life on the line. Fred Hampton was our most dynamic and charismatic speaker. He had been a field organizer for the NAACP. He was like a revolutionary pastor, the way he would preach, call and response. Jesse Jackson is famous for it. Fred Hampton, I think, did it first when he would ask folks. He would say, I am, and people would say, revolutionary. I love the community, folk. I will sacrifice my life for the struggle. Well, Fred was also a brilliant organizer. And what he did in Chicago was began to organize the gangs in Chicago, began to send Panthers into those toughest communities and get them to understand that the real enemy wasn't each other. It was a system. And then if you really talk about love for your people, then you have to love all your people. And that brother, no matter what color or what name of gang he's in, is your brother. That's your sister. Their mothers are your mothers. And the largest, toughest Latino gang in Chicago called the Young Lords politicized the leader, Cha-Cha Jimenez, and they became the Young Lords Party. They became a revolutionary party, adapted part of the Panther 10-point program, put down the guns in terms of gang fighting, organized breakfast programs, and was doing that with other gangs. And the city of Chicago, along with the FBI and the government, said he is a threat because he can turn this force that we kind of have contained because they're fighting one another into a force that outnumbers the police and that could really bring this change about, this armed struggle change that they were talking in Chicago. And the Chicago police kicked in Fred Hampton's door early in the morning, shot their way in, and killed Fred Hampton while he was asleep. Another Panther named Mark Clark was killed. The police said that there was a shootout. And this is why journalists are so important, radio journalists, television journalists. The Panthers drew some lessons from Mamie Till, Emmett Till's mother, who not too long earlier, who you know, like a decade or so earlier,
when she
brought
years,
her brought her son's body to Chicago, and said, "Leave the coffin open. I want everyone to see what happened to my son. This can't not happen to another black child." And 50,000 people came to see his body, and it ignited what we call the modern civil rights movement. People have to connect that incident to when Rosa Parks a few weeks later refused to give up her seat on the bus. That ignited it. It gave fire to the movement. The Panthers learned from that, and the Panthers said, "We are going to leave the apartment open. We want people to come see what happened." And so they didn't change the sheets. They didn't touch anything. And thousands of Chicagoans came to the Panther apartment. And a couple of young white journalists came in, and they looked at the pattern of the bullet holes in the apartment, and they saw that all of the bullets were coming inside.
All incoming.
Because you don't have to be a forensics expert. You know, bullets make a small hole going in and a larger hole in the exit. All of the bullet holes were going inside. If this was such a fierce shootout, if the Panthers put up such resistance, why all the bullet holes going in? And this led to articles and investigation that eventually proved that Fred Hampton was murdered. There was some settlement that happened years later with the families, you know, who were in that apartment, and the families of the, you know, Fred Hampton and the people who were in that apartment. But the point is that the Panthers knew and people understood that the state would respond with arrests, with frame-ups, with murders to try to suppress the movement.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is the author of Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. Our guest is Jamal Joseph, a former Black Panther who is now a professor at Columbia University's Graduate Film Division and the artistic director of the New Heritage Theater in Harlem. Let's get back to the Panther 21 trial. You were the youngest member of the famous, infamous, notorious, depending on what point of view you have, of the Panther 21. Do you feel then that your persecution, we were just talking about Fred Hampton, as part of the Panther 21 trial, was part of a larger conspiracy? How do you feel looking back on it now?
Yeah, I mean, it was that. It was clear to us then. I think it's clear to folks in history that the Panther 21 case was New York's version of dealing with what it considered to be its Panther problem. We could do it legally. We'll do it through a legal lynching. That number, the 21, was the number that District Attorney Frank Hogan felt represented all of the leadership of New York. And although I was 15 years old, I had become head of the high school cadres. Fannie Shakur, Tupac's mom, was also part of the Panther 21 case. And everybody who was doing political work and grassroots work who were officers in the various chapters were arrested. When I joined the Panthers, I never knew my dad. And my grandfather had passed away, when I was 12 years old. So for me, the journey to the Panther office was my path to manhood. I was trying to figure out how to be a man as much as I was trying to figure out how to be involved in the struggle. And you had this image of the Panthers. You coming up, you hang, if your dad's not around, or sometimes even if he is around, you kind of hang out either on the basketball court or the street corners, and you look at how the older guys walk and talk and how they do things and kind of pattern that. And for me, that journey led to the Panther office. And one of the people who mentored me, my section leader, Yewa, was someone who made sure that I, got to the breakfast program on time, learned the 10-point program. When I did finally get a gun, taught me how to shoot, taught me how to take this M16 rifle apart and put it back together blindfolded so that when was our turn to do guard duty in the office and do that, I could do that. Even came to my grandmother's house when she had found Panther literature in my room and said I couldn't go back to convince her to let me stay. Well, when we were arrested in the Panther 21 case, I found out that Yewa was an undercover cop. And he was part of an elite police unit in New York called the Boss Unit, the Bureau of Special Services. One of the other undercover cops was a guy named Gene Roberts, who had been Malcolm X's bodyguard, was a cop at that time, and was on stage just a few feet away when Brother Malcolm was shot. You can see the photo in Life magazine of him giving Brother Malcolm mouth-to-mouth resuscitation right after he was shot. So that's how they make cases like this. They use agent provocateurs and informers, and they take statements that are made in meetings, and they try to say, you're planning a conspiracy, you're planning to overthrow the government. And so we had a trial that lasted close to a year, where the government put on hundreds of witnesses and thousands of pieces of evidence, and we had a jury that we fought to get. We fought to get a diverse jury. We fought to get people of color on the jury and women on the jury. This trial that took almost a year, the jury was sequestered, and they came back 3 hours later with not guilty verdicts on all of the counts. So this wasn't, as I said, people that we didn't know before. They were people who listened to what was being said. And our strategy in the courtroom even then was, as the government was trying to put us on trial, we put the government on trial. We tried to look at everything that has happened, from lynchings, from the Ku Klux Klan, to the assassinations of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, and established that there was a pattern to try to criminalize, and this still happens today, criminalize folks who are standing up for social justice, and in particular standing up against the government and standing up against the exploitation of poor people, working people, people of color. Standing up, for example, against this new wave of mass incarceration of black boys that would much rather put a young black man in prison than into a university. When you stand up enough, you have to be prepared to understand the state will try to retaliate.
And speaking of the state retaliating, even though the Panther 21 case was a symbolic success and you guys beat that case, they ended up coming back and getting you anyway.
Well, this is true. I wound up spending a year and a half that time. But I wound up going back to prison. I came out and became one of the youngest national spokespersons for the Black Panther Party and an organizer. But I wound up spending a number of years in federal prison, not far from here, Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary, for being convicted for helping people out who were on the run for the FBI. So that charge is called an accessory. But if you help someone who's on the run and you know they're on the run, they can give you a lot of time. And they gave me the maximum time for that.
Speaking of which, when you were incarcerated, what did you discover about the movement and about yourself?
I discovered that this idea of the movement, two ideas that I carried with me, was that this movement wasn't just about black people, although black people had been the most oppressed by the system. We're talking about this 400-year crime of slavery against the black community worldwide, but that you had white people who were struggling, Latino people, Native American people. The Panthers' greeting was all power to the people. And then we break that down. We say that means black power to black people, white power to white people, brown power to brown people, et cetera. Power in the sense that there are more white folks at this moment on welfare in this country than than black folks. So we're talking about than anybody. So we're talking about poor working people who are all being victimized by a system that is about profit, not about people. And I also took with me this idea, and if you ask any Panther this, what was the number one thing that you were taught in the Panther Party? If you had to say there was an underlying principle, and feel free to do this for any future guest you have, anybody that you run into that were in the Panther Party, if you say there was one principle, one thing that you were brainwashed to believe among all other things, they will answer with these words or in similar words. They will say, we were taught to have love for the people. We were taught to serve the people. So it was this idea of struggle, class struggle, this idea of service. But I came into prison, and I learned two things. One, I was fortunate to have an old-timer, a brother who had been there a long time, give me some jailhouse wisdom. He said, young blood, he said, you can serve this here time, or you can let this time serve you. And at the time, they had a college program that St. Mary's College and University of Kansas, KU, brought into the prison where you could go to school full-time at night. You had to work. Everybody in the prison industrial complex has to work. You have to have a job. You got to work in the factories or someplace in prison. But at night, you could go to school full-time. So I started to really understand, let me take advantage of the power of education, the power of books, the power of reading. And the other thing that I came to understand really a little bit by accident was I was sitting in a yard and the same brother came over to me. He said, young blood, you a Panther? I said, yes, sir. He said, you did karate and stuff out there. So that was a little less public than that. And I said, yes, sir, I did. You know, I was a black belt and had fought in some tournaments. He said, and you did plays and stuff on the outside. And I was like, how did he know that? You know, because I had done some poetry and done some plays, you know, as part of the Black Arts Movement. And he said, well, you need to do something for Black History Month. I done checked it out with the warden. So I went to the prison library, tried to find a black play. There was only one. It was A Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry. And I came back and I said, I don't know if I could do this play. I said, you know, I found one play and it's got a lot of women characters in it. It's a character about a black matriarch trying to save her family. And the brother said, no, well, it's cool, brother. Do what you need to do. Pick out four or five guys. We'll put some dresses on them. I was like, no, I think I better try. I better try to write something. So I wrote a play, and I'm rehearsing with a couple of brothers that didn't want to really be actors, but we had also gotten, you know, the strong commission from Mr. Cody that we should do this play. And as we are rehearsing, some guys from the Latino section of prison, you know, prisons are segregated because guys segregate themselves into sections called courtyards or courts. So you have the Latino section, the black section, the white section, guys who are doing 25 years, 50 years, life in prison, right? Tough guys, men, you know, and you don't go into each other's court at all. It's neutral territory.
In other words, the Aryan Nation, LAME.
That's what you're talking about. You're talking about LAME, you're talking about Black Guerrilla Family, you're talking about all those crews.
Right.
So no joke. Kill you as soon as look at you, because if you're doing life, if you kill another prisoner, you get 10 to 15 years. So what's that if you're doing life anyway? What's more important is, you know, your reputation, your courtyard. So we're rehearsing, and in to the rehearsal comes two leaders of LAME, right? And these brothers had, not only were they doing life, they had taken out two or three guys since they had been in prison. So when they come into the rehearsal, our reaction is, LAME has left their court. We had gotten a little space, you know, above the gym to rehearse. LAME has left their court. These two guys in particular, who are they here to kill? So they sit down on the side, and I'm working with, you know, with two of the brothers. We're doing a little improv, and I'm looking out the corner of my eye, and one brother, Tito, he's looking like he's really upset. And I keep watching him. He's getting madder and madder. Something's really bothering him. Finally, after about 10 minutes, he jumps up. He was like, yo, I said, let me speak to you a minute. And he pulls me to the side, and I said, it's me. I knew this might be a bad idea. I knew somehow this involved the rules of the prison, you know, the convict code. I said, but just, you know, be man to man with the brother. Be straight up, you know. And he pulls me to the side. He says, yo, I said, there's no secrets about what you're doing here, Holmes. He says, we know everything going on in this joint. I had to come check it out for myself, S.A. And I've been sitting here for about 10 minutes, and I'm watching you, and I'm going to tell you something, Holmes, and I really want you to listen to me. That guy you're working with, Holmes, that guy, that effing guy, know, Holmes, he's not feeling his character.
You thought it was going to be something else.
I thought it was going to be some
and
static.
It was a critique it on was a how committed
exactly.
your actor was.
So I said, well, why don't you get in? So he got in. He made his friend get in. So that night I went and rewrote the play. It became like a Black and Latino Black History Month play. The white guys are now seeing the Latino brothers and the Black brothers sneak off someplace, and they think this is not good news for us. So their toughest guy, a guy called Reb. Reb's a 6'3", 250 pounds from lifting weights. He's a black belt in taekwondo. Reb comes up by himself. Reb comes back about 2 hours later. All the guys from his court surround him. Aryan Brotherhood guys, militia guys, bikers, bank robbers, kidnappers. You know, no punks. These are hard dudes in their own right. And they come around and they go, Reb, you was up there with the blacks and the Mexicans? Reb said, yep. They said, well, Reb, what's going on? He said, they're doing a play. They said, well, Reb, what'd you do about it? Reb said, well, you know, they give me a part. So we had a multicultural court. We had guys who were Vietnam veterans who were from these different gangs who were in there using the creative arts. And because they were telling their stories, of course we were dealing with social issues and social change. And that's when I came to understand the power not only of education, but the power of the creative arts as a force for social change.
And speaking of which, how is the arts a vehicle for activism?
Well, you know, the best example that I use is the griot, the African griot, who would sit in the center of the village underneath the tree that was called the baobab tree. And their job was to entertain and to educate, to talk about the history of the tribe, to talk about what was coming up, what people needed to be aware of and do. The griot had to do two things. The griot had to have the right information, but they had to be entertaining. They had to be able to do the drums and the poetry and do some music. If you didn't do both, you weren't a good griot, right? If you were a good griot and you were like, your creative skills wasn't, people would be like, yo, man, I'm not trying to mess with that griot unless I'm going to sleep. Let's go over to the other village. That griot can really put it down. You know, it can rap, it can play the drums. By the same token, if you were very entertaining and your facts were wrong, people would diss you. It'd be like, man, that griot, man, you know, I was on that hunt, you know, and it wasn't, say, cool, kill that lion. It was his little sister, Keisha. So you had to really – so the power of the creative arts for social change, look, it at its negative best, we have our young men – and women in our community modeling what they see in the movies and modeling what they see in music videos so that they think success is really being a gangster, selling some drugs, having a lot of women, shooting anybody that gets in their face. We have people actually modeling that behavior. In suburbs where, you know, in the suburban malls where hip-hop really sells, you see where people are really getting the CDs and downloading the stuff, it is entertainment. In our community, it becomes a model. It becomes a pattern. So what the creative arts has the ability to do is, first of all, shine the light on certain situations through film, through music, through television, to make us aware of what's going on, and then to help us model ways of how we respond, how we transform.
Our guest is former Black Panther Jamal Joseph. He's the author of the memoir Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. He's now a professor of film studies at Columbia University and the artistic director of the New Heritage Theater in Harlem. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we talk with Mr. Joseph about life after prison and life after the Black Panthers and how he entered the world of academia, plus the legacy of hip-hop icon Tupac Shakur. We'll be right back.
to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. As a child, I can remember getting up at dawn. I had those pajamas with the feet, and I didn't even change clothes to go outside. My mom and I piled into a car to make the more than 300-mile trip from Los Angeles to the San Francisco Bay Area. I was a 6-year-old headed to San Quentin Penitentiary. Back then, I wasn't sure why my mom was even taking me there in the first place. But last year, at the age of 36, I was forced to look back on my time as a child and understand the context of those trips and the tenor of those times. You see, the man we were going to see in prison was my godfather, Elmer Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt, a Black Panther in prison for a crime he didn't commit. He died in June of last year, ironically, on foreign soil in Tanzania. Joining us now for the second part of the hour to talk about the legacy of the Black Panthers, politically motivated imprisonment, and the aftermath of a tumultuous period in American history is our guest, Jamal Joseph, a former Black Panther and author of the memoir Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. He's now a professor and former chair of Columbia University's Graduate Film Division and the artistic director of the New Heritage Theater in Harlem. I made that intro, Mr. Joseph, to set it up because when my godfather G, as I called him, when he got out of prison, 27 years, in fact, for a crime he didn't commit and got exonerated in the late 90s, he said he wanted nothing to do with any political movements ever again. How did you feel when you got out of prison for the last time? Did you feel that way? Did you feel like you wanted nothing to do with any political movements, or did you want to kind of switch up?
I came to feel that I wanted to continue to struggle, but that I wanted to focus my work with young people and with the creative arts, because my time in Leavenworth really showed me that power. And my previous time in the movement as a young man, as a man-child, showed me that the movement was multifaceted. There were, in the Panther Party, people who were in different cadres. So there was a health cadre. There's a book that just came out on the health programs of the Black Panther Party and how groundbreaking they were. The idea that you could have a community clinic and started with nothing. Many Panther offices became health clinics on the weekends because we would get young doctors and young nurses who would come and volunteer their time and bring their medical bag and take a little medicine from their whatever their day jobs were to treat hypertension and sickle cell and to treat that right in the community. And it changed their lives in terms of how they gave health care the rest of their lives. Legal clinics, liberation schools, schools that were started in people's apartments after school and on Saturdays, Panther offices, so that you weren't waiting for permission or funding to save your people and do that work in the community. There was a Black arts movement. We would go to a place called the East Wind, and we would hear people like Sonia Sanchez and Amiri Baraka and the Last Poets. So you realize that culturally it could be cool and entertaining and that you could really spread a message kind of doing those things. So my period of feeling that I wanted nothing to do with the struggle actually was a period in between my prison terms, where I went through what I later came to know was post-traumatic stress, where I started to numb myself out with drugs and alcohol and just kind of wanted to hang out and not do anything. And then I got involved again, helping some folks get out of prison and get away, federal warrants and other folks that were looking for them. And then I came to prison and got reignited, not only because of I realized that I had some knowledge and some abilities where I could organize prisoners, but through the creative arts. And so that became my focus. But a lot of people went through that. A lot of people fought on the battlefield so long and so hard just to feel, especially if you looked at how things were in the 80s, just to feel like, where has it gone? Where did that sacrifice gone?
Right. And to give background on that, America went to war on the Black Panthers and other organizations in the early to mid 70s. We start to see the party disintegrate due to, you know, leadership crises and also due in large part to the government's counterintelligence or COINTELPRO program. What was it like to witness the downfall and disintegration of the organization that you held so dear?
Well, we didn't know the full import of what was happening with this program, COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, which was designed by the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover's leadership, but embraced by many, many different police agencies and government agencies. What COINTELPRO did, just to give it context, was that they would use informers, they would infiltrate, they would plant evidence, they would encourage local police to do these raids. So they'd go back and forth saying the Panthers are getting ready to attack, you need to move preemptively. They would tell the Panthers, you know, the cops are getting ready to attack, so fortify the office and engineer a lot of the shootouts and a lot of the things that happened that led to Panthers being killed, police being killed, people going to prison for the rest of their lives. Some folks who were still there, most notably Mumia Abu-Jamal, who had his death sentence commuted but is doing life, you know, in the state of Pennsylvania. Geronimo Pratt, as you mentioned, who did 27 years for a crime that he didn't commit. Daruba Ben-Wahad, who was a member of the Panther 21 that spent 20-plus years in prison for a crime that he didn't commit. And many, many who were still in prison. But being in the midst of it, you saw what was a great organization going at war with itself. You saw the leadership from the East Coast, you know, in battle with the leadership from the West Coast. And you saw this kind of divide and, you know, East Coast, West Coast Black Panther Party.
And then gender politics as well when Elaine Brown takes over in Huey P. Newton's absence.
Right, exactly. And so you had all of this now infighting and you're wondering, what is the struggle really about? As you're seeing the community get devastated and the organization. And meanwhile, beside the political battles, Panthers are being killed and going to prison every day.
Wholesale.
Wholesale. So you have to imagine, I like to put it in context with young people. If you were on a basketball team with a group of people, or if you were in the you know, a church group, or if you were in a dance group, and you spent time with them every day doing what you believed in, and then somehow people started being killed, going to prison and being wiped out, so that by, and you started this when you were 15, so that by the time you were 17, two-thirds of the people that you were around were on the run, dead or in jail. Imagine how traumatic that is. Just in human terms, and then couch that politically, knowing that you just try to do what you could do every day for your community. That's what you did 24/7. Then, post-Panther, imagine walking the streets of Harlem or Philadelphia or Chicago, any of these places that look like pure war zones. I'm just talking about the crumbling buildings that slumlords had walked away from, people living in half-abandoned buildings, rats running, the crack epidemic that swept the country, and you're looking at these same streets where you went to war with the drug dealers, where you were doing health clinics, and you would feel like, what was it for? But the hope of this always becomes, and this is one of the things I like to say to people, because now everybody was a Panther. I'm serious. I go to some place and they go, my uncle was a Panther, this was a Panther, and I, you know, my auntie was a Panther, my grandfather was a Panther. And I said, if all of these people were really Panthers, we would have had about 100,000 members. You know, I think at our peak we had 15, you know, 20,000, maybe less. But what I say is, if someone said that they were in the movement, in the Black Panther Party, I want you to quietly look at their face when a child comes into the room or when an elder comes into the room, and if you see pure love in their eyes, whether that child is a relative or not, whether they met them before, whether they know the elder person, if you see pure love in their eyes, then they might have been a Panther, or certainly they were around us. So that love has a way of catching hold again, right? That one principle. And Panthers now that you see who were a part of the original Black Panther Party, who are now teaching or who are doing community work, who've come back, who struggle through their own disappointment, their own depression, their own battles, have found ways to get connected with different aspects of the struggle. And there's a healing that has come about through understanding that there's still work to be done, and that the big part of the work is empowering this younger generation with knowledge and as many tools as we can so that the struggle can continue.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is former Black Panther Jamal Joseph, author of Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. He's now a full professor at Columbia University's Graduate Film Division and the artistic director of the New Heritage Theater in Harlem. Part of your enduring legacy is mentoring and being Uncle Jamal to the late, great Tupac Shakur, and knowing his mother, Afeni, as a teenager. Tell us about Tupac. My mom babysitted Tupac, by the way.
I'm getting ready to say, and by virtue of the fact that Geronimo was also Tupac's godfather, that's your godbrother.
I know that's my godbrother.
Right.
Yeah.
And Tupac, was an amazing child and an amazing man. And, you know, the media has a way, in the same way that I go around and when I give speeches, two of the things that I have to say right away to a lot of folks who don't have the history is that, number one, the Black Panthers was not a racist organization. And that, number two, the Black Panther Party was not obsessed with violence. So I have to talk about class struggle and the breakfast program to kind of, you know, put it in perspective to what being a Panther was really about. But that's not what you see in the media, because this, it's the sensationalism that in those days sold magazines, newspapers, and got people to watch the 6 o'clock news. It was the Panthers, you know, ferocity and standing up. Those are the things that got covered. The shootouts with the police. Those are the things that got covered. When that kind of, you know, actually holding a gun and doing community patrols and doing that was probably 5% of your life as a Panther. 95% were the things that we've been talking about. The same is true in the way that history is trying to remember Tupac Shakur. You'll see the things that were the press bites that sold papers when Tupac, cursed at a reporter, or when Tupac, you know, got into a shootout with police. You know, you hear that. But the majority of what Tupac was about his art and was about his mentoring and about his love for folks. Tupac had an army of young people around him that he was mentoring in a really positive way. Tupac would do things like when a friend who had been killed, when his daughter was going to prom and he found out that she didn't have a prom date, showed up and took her to the prom and was like the prom date just to do that. What Tupac should be remembered for is this code of thug life that he created in conjunction with gang members, street soldiers, and men who were in prison, about what we have to do in our communities to make our communities safe, reminding people who were street people some rules of the street that we've forgotten along the way, that you don't pull out guns and shoot in front of kids, that you don't sell drugs, that you don't do these things, that you don't disrespect women. This is a clear kind of thing of thug life that created gang truces and began to make people understand what we have to do for ourselves and our communities.
But to be fair, there was a fine line that Tupac had to walk between his Panther legacy and Black activism and the reality of the crack epidemic and the crack era epidemic and the Black on Black crime and the gang and the sort of thug era of Black men killing young Black men that he and I grew up in. And he had to walk a fine line between that.
It was a crazy line. And by the way, when you're in your 20s, you're trying to figure it all out anyway. So you're moving at hyperspeed and you have this fame and you have all of these pressures and you've got court cases pending. This is very similar to what I described to you earlier that we were going through in the Black Panther Party. When we asked that question, when Brother James Baldwin said there was that spiritual core that was missing, there was that moment. There was that moment that was missing that I called a time to take a quiet breath and really reflect. And that's what was kind of devoid. And considering all of that and considering what anyone who is like in their late teens through their 20s going through trying to figure all that pattern out, it's amazing that he kept as much balance as he did. One of the stories that I tell in the book and that I'm happy to share here is that when I went to see Tupac in prison, after he was convicted for the sexual misconduct. I mean, I was there when Tupac was shot the first night, and when he wanted to leave the hospital. I'm one of the people that convinced the police and the hospital security that he's signing himself out. If he's not under arrest, please get out of our way. And as a matter of fact, open the back door so we can not deal with the fans and all of the press. And so when I went to see Tupac, we had a moment that went something like this. He said, "Uncle Jamal," we hugged. I was a paralegal, so I was able to have one-on-one time. He had on his prison oranges, and he came out, and he was still limping. He'd been shot just a few weeks earlier several times, and he hugged me, and he said, "Uncle Jamal, before you start," he said, "back here in the prison ward, a young brother came down who has to get a back operation. He saw me. He said, 'Tupac, you my hero. You my hero, dog.'" And Tupac said, "Time out, brother. Why am I your hero?" He said, "Oh, come on, Pac. Don't be playing." He said, "You be shooting at the police, you got the women, you be getting paid." He said, "Time out. That's why I'm your hero? Then I don't need to be anybody's hero." And he said, "Uncle Jamal, I realize that I'm going to die because I'm a Shakur." He said, "But my question is, do I go out like Malcolm X or like Tony Montana from Scarface?" He says, "I want to go out like Malcolm." So I said, "Well, Pac, let's not think about, your death." You know, I said,
the reality is he went out like both.
He did. He went out like Bo.
Such an iconic figure that he went out.
He did go out like Bo.
Las Vegas. The yes. price of Las Vegas. And one of his last public appearances was saying, if I can sell 2 million, if the Dog Pound can sell 5 million, if Dr. Dre can sell this X amounts of million, we can get those types of million people to vote. You never see that type of footage.
You never
hardly ever see that.
You never see that covered.
So and that dichotomy was
that dichotomy. Striking. He was yeah. clear. So mm-hmm. after I did what any godfather would do, saying let's not focus on your death, let's focus on life, he began to lay out his plan for what he wanted to do in terms of youth centers and in terms of social justice movements, but involving the youth in art and creative change. And I said, Pac, what's different now from when we used to bump heads about this? And he said, I'm clear-headed now. He said, I was running so fast before. He says, I was smoking weed all the time. I'm just doing it. So I said, what does that tell you? He says, I have to be clear every day. He said, the way mom is clear every day. Deal with recovery one day at a time and make these things happen. Well, I may have been one of the first people he said this to, but Tupac, when he believed something, said it to everybody. And when he came out of prison, people that Pac was saying is, I'm not smoking, I'm not drinking anymore, began to say, let's give him some weed, let's give him this, let's give him that, let's keep him going. He already acknowledged that this was something that he didn't want to do so much. So when you have someone with the best intentions, but you're not surrounded by those folks who have the best intentions or who care about things like what's going on in the community with young black men, with the arts, with education, with progressive movements, the way you care about it, you can get pulled in different directions and you can be exploited even in your strengths.
What's your take on the post-Panther generation of young black males conflicted, imperiled, dying in the streets? And what are your thoughts on the term post-racial? That's a two-pronged, complex question that we're going to
post-racial I can deal with rather quickly.
Okay.
It was nice while it lasted, which was probably about, 60 days after President Obama was elected.
Right.
It's very clear wherever you go. And it's very clear when you deal with the incidents of Trayvon Martin and when you deal with the brother in Arkansas who, somehow managed to shoot himself while he was handcuffed, according to the police, and the young brother in the Bronx who the police followed to his home and shot him down. And this statistic that says, that shows us that one in eight young black men may graduate from high school and go to college, but one in three are guaranteed to go to prison. When I was in prison, I've been home for about 25 years. The United States was number three in the amount of people that it had incarcerated behind the then Soviet Union in South Africa, about 500,000 people. Now we are unquestionably number one, 2 million plus, most of them black and brown boys. This is an outright attack. Prisons make profit, so it's profitable, and they're dealing with their problem of this potential revolutionary army. And whether they're fighting with law books and shotguns the way the Panthers did, or whether they're using technology, whether they're using business, grassroots organizing to change, this is a force of change that when you eliminate those numbers, you solve your, and you're a government trying to stay in power, you're taking care of, killing two birds with one stone, getting rid of this potentially revolutionary army, and also making money as you incarcerate them. We are in an epidemic, a real crisis. And so this movement against mass incarceration in New York, we have a strong movement against stop and frisk of young black boys of what's going on. This deliberate lack of education in our communities, these corporations that check reading scores at third and fourth grade for black boys to determine how many prisons to build, not how many schools to build. We are on the front lines of a struggle that we must attack on every level. It has to be policy. It has to be grassroots organizing and very, very important. It needs to be like the brothers who are in this room, yourself, myself, mentoring, putting our arms around one or two young brothers personally so that they can understand that there's an alternative, that there's a roadmap, and that this image of manhood that on a street corner may have on a particular bandana, may have on, a particular color, that there's another image that you can touch that comes to work every day, that wears a tie sometimes, that wears a vest sometimes, that came from the same circumstances you did, that had friends who were killed, that have relatives in prison, that can show you another way. It's the most important battle we can fight these days.
Our guest is Jamal Joseph, former Black Panther and author of the memoir Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. He's a professor of film studies at Columbia University. Thank you for joining us for this very enlightening conversation.
Thank you, brother. It was a real pleasure being here.
And tune in for tomorrow's show. Our show is produced by Tamika Weatherspoon, executive produced by Bill Anderson. Kim Noble is our announcer. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney, and the outro is by the Wilnots. Up to Date is next. I'm Jabba Lion Lafall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.